Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, January 19th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Rethinking Intelligence. In fact, I should have called it Rethinking Everything. We're going to interview Lynn McTaggart. We interviewed her from London because we had to pre-record, London being so far ahead. And it's a wonderful interview, 50 minutes. We're going to go a little bit over. And we're really talking about the fundamental nature of reality, a very different picture, science now says, including human reality, how we connect with each other, how we share knowledge and feelings. It's a fascinating topic. If you haven't read her books, I hope you do. And I hope today inspires you to do so. While we revisit these questions of the fundamental nature of reality and intelligence, there's a noticeable absence of intelligence in Washington this day. These days, lunatic legislation I'm going to talk about. A couple things I want to mention for Soleri Report subscribers. We have the transcript almost ready for the wrap-up. It'll go up on the blog early next week, and I really encourage you to take a look at that if you didn't listen to the wrap-up. The transcript is going to be very graphical, and it will have a list of the movies and heroes we had in 2011, and I think it will be really useful again. You have my permission to share it with your intimate friends and family if it would be useful for them to you to for them to have that knowledge. A great piece, a speech I did in Mill Valley that's streaming on the internet and is available to all subscribers, Investment Strategies for Changing Times. It gives an excellent framework on how to look at the volatility and deal with the volatility that we're going to experience this year. We certainly experienced it last year. So I encourage you to take a look at that, and it's all part of your subscription. Finally, I'm meeting with Montana and Idaho subscribers this Saturday. I'm really excited. We're all going to have lunch at Benelli's Cafe in Kalispell, Montana. If you are within shooting distance of the Flathead Valley in Montana, you're certainly welcome. It's, again, Benelli's Cafe this Saturday at 12:30. I'm going to be in the Rogue Valley, Oregon next week, a whole series of speaking events and workshops. It's all described on the events section of the website. Finally, Cambridge House has invited me to speak in their Natural Resources Conference in Palm Springs, February 11th. That's an open event. I encourage you to come if you're in the area. Money and markets. The markets have started off strong this year. It's beginning to look like an election year market. The S&P moved up through 1,300. The U.S. dollar index is holding over 80. Lots of other things up, including silver and gold. The beneficiary, no doubt, of Fukushima, General Motors reported this week that they've returned to their spot as the number one global automakers, beating Toyota, who had taken over the lead in 2007. So everything is looking hunky-dory in the United States right now, but there's serious trouble underneath the carpet. We saw the forces of decentralization really assert themselves this week. There's an old New Jersey street saying, I've used this quote at the front of my book about Dylan Reed and the aristocracy of stock profits. The saying is, make a law, make a business. Washington's efforts to make laws that will assert fascist control of the global economy are frightening, particularly because they're so destructive to markets and to equity. We saw a blackout on Wednesday in response to the House Stop Online Piracy Act, the proposed act in the Senate is the Protect IP Act. So you're seeing acronyms SOPA and PIPA. And thousands of websites were blacked out. Wikipedia, the most famous. We had a banner up on our site participating as well with a link to the explanation of Electronic Frontier Foundation of what the problems with that bill are. Needless to say, if we find ourselves in a situation where the government can turn off any website or internet provider, we're talking about a world where the value of any given business that depends on the internet is really completely dependent on politics. So your equity is worthless other than as a proprietary of the U.S. government. We saw Ron Powell come out strongly to reverse the provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act, and a very passionate email today from Foster and Kimberly Gamble of Thrive, encouraging that we all sign the petition to reverse the National Defense Act. I've signed that petition. I've also emailed my congressman and senator about internet privacy, and I encourage you to do the same. You'll find lots of links up on the website. Part of the shocking stories in that was Sheriff Mack, Richard Mack, who was on the Solari Report, wonderful retired sheriff from Arizona and a real supporter of the Constitution and the power of the sheriff under the Constitution, was organizing a conference. PayPal withheld $40,000 of his money, and it certainly not only makes you nervous about the efforts to really use the Internet to do good, but also about the insecurity of PayPal. To make matters worse, we see two of the best congressmen in the House, Marcy Kaptur and Dennis Kucinich, now pitted against each other in the primaries in Ohio. One of the most bizarre redistricting between Toledo and Cleveland is now going to pit those two against each other, so only one can come out and win. And believe you me, they're both very, very valuable members of Congress. I'd hate to lose either one of them. The deflation on Main Street continues. Although we're seeing unprecedented increases in the money supply, if you look at the squabbles over capital, we continue to see real efforts to direct capital in certain directions and keep it from going elsewhere. On internationally, the one colleague sent me a circular that came from their central bank in the Middle East saying that they would not send or receive wires to seven sanctioned countries, including Iran. So you just see the tightening of the vise. But tremendous number of reports to me over the last 2 weeks from Main Street on capital, on banks cutting back, loans being harder to get. One story from an attorney that was unbelievable, I just got permission to read it today. They told of a mortgage owned by a big bank using Fannie Mae. Let me just read it to you. They committed fraud by filing a mortgage assignment purporting to transfer the mortgage from one place to the bank. They backdated documents. They served papers on the borrower, giving her notice to leave, which she believed was legal. She is a professional and widow with a young son who had defaulted because due to illness. She needed a loan modification. The bank told her she had to default to get a loan modification. They have never foreclosed. They made changes to documents long after she had signed them. They forced placed property insurance to an affiliate, raising the annual premium by $6,000 a year after she moved to live with her mother because she had nowhere else to go. They told her she didn't qualify for a HAMP loan because she did not live in the property. They broke into the house and plastered it from the inside with no trespassing and their big bank name signs. This is while it was on the market. This was a pristine $500,000 house she put an additional $40,000 into that is now a mess. The borrower had put down $120,000 down payment for an interest-only loan. And so, you know, I get many, many stories like this of dirty tricks and cutting off capital to both families and small business. And it's one of the reasons I'm really looking forward to being in the Rogue Valley, Oregon, next week. We're going to be talking about community currency and all sorts of other nuts and bolts mechanisms that people can use to reverse the kind of deflation that's going on and build liquidity. Speaking of liquidity, I had the opportunity to read Kickstarter's year-end sort of wrap up and their best stories of the year. It turns out through crowdfunding, they've now raised $100 million for projects. Meantime, the legislation to make crowdfunding available to do equity investment is still dead in the water. The theory is that it would promote a lot of fraud. It's always funny to compare the kind of fraud you could see on small business and crowdfunding for equity in communities and compare it to the lotteries. Lotteries drain millions and millions and billions of dollars out of small communities and out of communities all across the country. And there's no small business venture capital that could be more money-losing or dangerous or fraudulent than the fundamental economics of the lottery. Our hero tonight is Bill Moyers, who's back with his new show. Bill Moyers has for many decades been a favorite of mine. He continues to do amazing journalism and really purport to or really communicate very sound values and philosophy despite everything and build a lot of support across many constituencies for his work. So he's back on with his new show, Moyers & Company, and we welcome him back and thank him for never giving up despite all the headwinds he's had to overcome to continue to produce his show. One question in Ask Catherine, a question about MF Global making people nervous about leaving precious metals in depositories. Do I think gold money is safe in the long run? The answer is yes, I do think gold money is safe in the long run. At the same time, what I've been describing is a series of efforts by the financial system and the government to constantly compromise people's rights, and certainly MF Global was an example of a real compromising of rights with the help of the government and the regulators, or the tolerance of the regulators. And I think the reality is it's very important to understand there is no financial mechanism that can stand against tyranny, because ultimately if you have government and regulators acting in criminal ways, you know, there's no place that's safe other than what a community can organize or defend, including even with force. And so that's why it's so important that we not try and address tyranny with financial mechanisms, but understand that tyranny has to be dealt with collective intelligence and collective action. And it's one of the reasons I think that Lynn McTaggart's work is so important. Anyway, but to just wrap up this question, there are numerous depositories that I think are remarkably safe under the circumstances. Gold money is one of them. There's another that you can look into where you can leave precious metals anonymously. They have a website. It's in Austria. It's called Das Safe. You can take a look at that as well. But I think there are many mechanisms to do so. Yes, you can always keep physical gold at home. But, you know, at some point, I think all things, in all things balance. And I trust gold money and Das Safe and arrangements like that a lot more than, unfortunately, some of my neighbors. So, in all things balance. And I think if you listen to the investment strategies or my audio seminar, Position Your Assets, I think it's very good to have diversification in where you have your assets and where you have your holdings. So a multiplicity of arrangements is best. Okay, so let me turn to our interview with Lynn McTaggart. As I said before, I interviewed Lynn earlier this week from London. She's the author of a series of books, the most recently The Field, which and then The Intention Experiment, and finally her most recent, The Bond, subtitled Connecting Through the Space Between Us. Lynn has done a remarkable job of translating very important and cutting-edge scientific research and making it not only possible for the lay reader to understand it, but integrating research from many different fields to help us understand how this research applies to our everyday lives. And it's really a remarkable achievement. And her work really picks up on some of the conversations we had last year with Adam Trombley and Dr. William Tiller and Foster Gamble, the producer of Thrive. So with no further ado, let us now begin the interview with Lynn McTaggart. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome today to this Elyria Report Lynn McTaggart, who comes from us from London. And I've asked her to start by talking a little bit about her background and how she came to be an author and then to write The Field. So Lynn, welcome, and thank you so much for agreeing to join us on this Elyria Report.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I got started in the field really because I edit a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You, soon to be a magazine, by the way, an international magazine, we're thrilled to say. And every month we look at what works and what doesn't work in medicine and better alternatives. And in the course of doing that in the early 90s, I kept coming across a lot of good studies, really good scientific studies of things like spiritual healing. And that just set me back a bit. I kept thinking to myself, well, if you can have a thought, send it to somebody else, and make that person better, which is basically what spiritual healing is, then this really undermines everything we think about of the way the world works. So I wanted to find out how this could be, you know, how this could work. And I also was a little distrustful of some of the terms being used at the time, things like subtle energy. I kept thinking, well, you know, if you can make somebody better with your thoughts, there's nothing subtle about this. You know, this is pretty powerful. So how does it work? And I thought I would probably just speak to some frontier scientists. I have a background in investigative reporting, so I'm used to really in-depth reporting. And I thought, well, I'll just speak to these guys, and they'll tell me how it works. They'll tell me that there's something like human energy fields around. Write up the book, and that'll be that. And, you know, I was completely unprepared for what I found, which was a bunch of scientists on the brink of a complete revolution in our understanding of the way the world works and the way we work. And so I was astonished by that. And also astonished by the work I'd taken on, because all these scientists speak in code. You know, they talk in math, basically. And so it's hard for them to talk about their work to the general public. So I realized I was going to have to be an interpreter. And that was daunting. But another even more daunting idea was that scientists don't like to venture outside of their own patch, their area of experimentation, and speculate about what this all means. And I realized with kind of growing alarm that that job was going to have to be left to me. So I wrote the field, and the field is really about the fact that we are insubstantial as individuals. We're part of this vast energy field, this vast quantum field. And that led me, really thinking about that, led me to the other work that I've done since, the other books I've done since.
The field for me was a remarkable experience. I read it when it first came out, and I'd been struggling to try and find and understand many of the things you write about, and trying to understand the scientists for me was very, very difficult and time-consuming, but also trying to integrate it. And, of course, you described much that I had not found. And so sometimes I think you can't underestimate the power of a good translator, because your writing is very beautiful, it's very clear, and you integrate tremendous, things from physics, things from psychology, things from biology, and it's really remarkable, you know, and the book is so clear and so well written that you make it seem easy. But having struggled with it before you published the book, I have to tell you, it's really quite remarkable.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a hard book to write. All the books I have done, these last three, have been hard books to write, because it is trying to not only interpret, but trying to synthesize all of this work and to basically say, well, what does this really mean about who we are and also how we're supposed to live? And that was the real interest I had ultimately. The field made me question how we live today, because, you know, we live according to a couple of basic assumptions that have come to us via science, you know, and they are, A, the fact that we are all individuals. And we've really got that ever since the days of Isaac Newton, that we are individuals in a very well-behaved universe, and that we operate as individual things according to fixed laws in time and space. And the other assumption is that, you know, life is essentially a race to the finish line. You know, it's a competitive world out there, and it's survival of the fittest. And there isn't enough out there, so we all have to compete to survive. So those things have really formed, essentially, our underlying belief system. And from there, we've constructed our world. And after I finished the field, I realized, my goodness, we have to rethink everything. We've got to build again, essentially, from scorched ground, you know, blow up our societal creations, essentially, and start over, because we're very different from what we've been told. And that really means we have to live in a very different way. And, of course, we're seeing this now. You know, we're seeing the breakdown of all of our societal structures.
Right. One of the reasons I valued the field so much is my interest had started as I was an investment banker, and I did a great deal of work during the 90s to break down the economy with new software tools and databases. And I found that the markets and the economy weren't optimizing around financial returns the way you're taught in business school. In fact, it defied everything I learned in business school. You know, that if you looked at a community and how the economy in a community worked, or a place, it worked very much around clusters of knowledge and culture. And if you read mm-hmm. your book, you go much further than business school to describing how our economic activity really flows. And a lot of it flows around our thoughts, our intentions, our connection, our learning. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I came at it from a different place, but it resonated tremendously. And, of course, then the more I learned, I read the field and some of your other stuff, it resonated with sort of my day-to-day life and my relationships with family and people. Well, let's go on to how were you surprised by the success of the field? Because my recollection was it was really a phenomena.
Yeah, and it wasn't initially. It just grew over a couple of years. I was surprised. My publishers on both sides of the Atlantic thought it was a special book, but I wasn't really prepared for how many people would feel that it was their Bible. And I thought that was really wonderful because it's exactly what you've said. I've heard exactly what you've said, you know, as an economist, from people in all kinds of industries, from science
uh-huh.
and, you know, engineers are big fans. The military is a big fan of the book because they found with people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, the only thing that seems to work are very weird modalities like thought field therapy and emotional freedom techniques, and they can't figure out how that works, and so the field gives them a structure for it. So I find uh-huh. that so many people find the field, so many people from so many diverse modalities and types of therapies and belief systems find the field as their Bible. So I was thrilled about that. I was really thrilled.
So how did the field, how did that evolve into the intention experiment? Maybe if you could introduce what that book and that
sure.
website and what you've been doing.
Okay. And by the way, for the field, people who want to know anything more can come to my main website, which is lynnmctaggart.com. For the intention experiment, after I wrote the field, I was left with a lot of unfinished business. Some thoughts, I mean, a lot of implications about the fact that thoughts are an actual something with the ability and capacity to affect physical matter. And, you know, the journalist, the sort of no-nonsense investigative journo in me, kept thinking to myself, well, how far can we take this? You know, if our thoughts can change things, can we cure cancer with our thoughts? You know, can I use it to fly up to the top of my roof and fix my satellite dish? You know, what can I do with this? And I was also interested in the philanthropic implications of it because, you know, a lot of people had written about the use of intention to manifest stuff for yourself and, you know, to get a better job and to get a bigger car. And I kept thinking, well, you know, if this is so powerful, then we want to use this to clean up the planet, to heal the world. So the intention experiment really came out of interest in, you know, looking at how far we can take intention. What's the science of intention? But also, what happens when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? I had talked a little bit about that in the field, and I'd looked a bit more into this, the idea of group intention, and the evidence was tantalizing but not conclusive. And so it was my husband who really turned to me one day and said, you know, I couldn't find any evidence about, real powerful evidence about the, you know, the effect of group intention. And he said, well, why don't you do these experiments yourself? And that sounded really preposterous because I'm not a scientist. But then when I started to think about it, the field is in 27 languages, so I have lots of readers around the world. And I know lots of scientists from doing these books. And so I thought, well, if I put this together and I set up periodic experiments on my website, I'm going to have the biggest global laboratory in the world. And that's really what we've been doing. I mean, we've run 24 experiments to date, and 18, looks like it's going to be 19 soon, have shown positive, demonstrable, significant effects in everything from changing the way plants grow to purifying water and even to lowering violence.
Tell us about the lowering violence one, because I've read about it, but I didn't participate.
Well, we did one in 2008 in Sri Lanka, and we ran it for 8 days, and I had people from all over the world participating. And at the time, there was a 25-year civil war that had been going on, with the rebels basically winning, and they had controlled the north. We set an intention for those 8 days, and during that time, this is very worrying to us, violence quadrupled, and then it plummeted by something like 80%. And the war completely changed direction from that week. We had a team of scientists on this, and they analyzed the statistics for it, and they found that just there was a complete change in what happened during that week and what happened in the war. And then afterward, within a few months, the government took over the north, which had been controlled by the rebels. And about 5 months later, this war, this intractable war, was over. Now, it was a really bizarre change. And even our very mild-mannered statistical professor who was looking at these said, this is really weird, because it seemed like that week was a pivotal moment.
Uh-huh.
So we ran another one this past year, marking the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This one at 9. We started an 8-day event once again at 9/11, and we haven't finished looking at the data, because what we tend to do is like a 2+ year time analysis. I let about 2 or 3 months pass to see what happens. And then we do a whole mapping of what happened before, an analysis of what's likely to happen next, and then we look at whether we've deviated from it. So it becomes a more powerful statistical result than just saying, oh, yeah, violence went down the week afterward, because that could be anything. So it's looking very positive, like for the first time, the two provinces that we sent intention to in Afghanistan this time have had a lowering of violence. And we had a remarkable event. I worked with a guy who is pretty much like the Deepak Chopra of the Middle East, and he invited tens of thousands of Arabs to join with our tens of thousands of Westerners. And we had people from 75 countries, including all of the Arab states, participating. So it uh-huh. was an amazing event, and this guy Salah, who is the Deepak Chopra, began by apologizing on behalf of the Arab countries. I then responded by apologizing back for the Western countries in our response. So he apologized for 9/11, and I apologized for the very violent response in Afghanistan and Iraq to 9/11,
uh-huh.
which resulted in the death, detaining, injury, or deporting of hundreds of thousands of totally innocent Arabs. So it was a remarkable event, and we're still, you know, we're still number crunching, but it looks very positive.
And how do you measure when you crunch the numbers? What's in those numbers? It's just violent events?
No, we look at all casualties, injuries, and deaths of both,
okay.
and with this case, we're doing both civilians and the military, combined forces. And we look okay. at them from 2 years back. So we're looking at monthly statistics from 2 years prior to September 11th, 2011,
uh-huh.
and then the
uh-huh.
3 months afterward. And we create a time analysis. Now, I don't do this, a scientist does. And she looks at what should have happened on the base of what did happen. That's a time analysis, statistical analysis. And if we deviate enormously from what is the predicted should have happened, then that becomes something very interesting, just as we did with Sri Lanka.
Now, how did participating in these experiments change you personally? How has it impacted your life? Because I would think this would be a very gratifying experience.
Well, yeah, because of the very simple fact that although there was a lot of amazing evidence about the power of intention that I put in the intention experiment, you know, there was only tantalizing evidence, nothing conclusive about the power of group intention. So the bottom line was, I didn't know it was going to work. You know, I assumed it was going to work. I suspected it was going to work. All signs pointed to the idea it was going to work, but we didn't know. And so I was surprised and delighted, and so were the scientists I was working with. You know, they'd all seen the power of intention, but we didn't know what it was going to be. You know, it was going to be this powerful. And I mean, remember, in all of the cases of the intention experiments we do, we have a target sitting in some laboratory somewhere. So oftentimes it's been the University of Arizona. What we post on our website is a photograph of the target, not the target itself. So people are sending remote intention from all over the world via their computer screens all at the same time to a picture, basically, to a photograph. And the object itself changes. You know, what we do, for instance, when we were doing the plant experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz, my scientist, a psychologist at the University of Arizona, created a very well-controlled experiment where we had four possible targets, which were sets of seeds. And I chose randomly the seeds we were going to send intention to. Gary did not know which ones we did until after he'd done his analysis of the effects. So we'd send intention to the seeds. He'd plant all of the seeds and water them, and then measure them 5 days later to see which ones grew the highest. And in every instance, it was the seed sent intention. Now, he didn't know they were the seed sent intention until after he'd done the measurements. Then I would reveal the target to him. So we were doing this as a blinded experiment, and we ran it six times, and every single time it worked. So, this is the thing. I think he was stunned by this too, because as I say, we're sending intention, first of all, remotely, and then to a photograph of an object that is thousands of miles away from all the people sending intention.
Right.
I was pretty blown away by it.
Was sort of the experiments and the results of the experiments what then inspired you to write The Bond?
Well, I had, after writing The Field, as I mentioned, I really knew that I needed to look at how we live and maybe how we're supposed to live. And I think what really inspired me to write The Bond was the mess we're in. That was one of the big reasons. Watching the collapse of so many of our institutions. I basically sold the book a month after the stock market crash in 2008.
Okay. So you started
because I thought, you know what, this is just the beginning of this. This is the beginning of the end of days for these systems. And I think we're at the end of capitalism here as we know it. And so I started thinking about that, and I started thinking about why we're in the mess we're in. And it came down to the fact that we're living according to a paradigm that essentially boils down to I win, you lose, you know, and that we are operating according to the idea that in every area of our lives, whether it's education or business or, you know, our financial model, our neighborhoods, even our relationships, are all about this false sense that we need to dominate each other and that we can only win by somebody else losing. And I really wanted to ask a basic question. You know, is this the way we're supposed to live? Was this the way we were designed to live? And if not, how are we supposed to be? And what are we supposed to do about it? So that really became The Bond, is, you know, how else should we live?
Well, let's just open up and start going through the bond. Why don't you tell, the subtitle on the bond is Connecting the Space Between Us. And I just have to read this.
Connecting through the space between us.
I'm sorry, did I? Connecting through the space. I have to read the quote that you used, which I thought was remarkable.
Thank you.
From Arthur Miller, and this is the quote at the front of the book. Everything was being destroyed, but it seemed to me that one new thing was made, a kind of responsibility, man for man, to bring that onto the earth again like some kind of monument, and everyone could feel it standing there behind him, and it would make a difference to him. And that's really what you've done. You know, it's quite remarkable.
No, well,
so,
thank you.
So let's start through the bond, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about the superorganism.
Sure. Well, as I said earlier in our interview, you know, we proceed on a premise, a series of premises about who we are. And, you know, lots of things write the story that we live by, you know, religion, philosophy. But the biggest author really is science, the biggest author for us in the West. You know, science tells us who we are, and from there we determine how to live. And science has essentially told us that we are individuals, that the world is filled with individual, self-contained things, and that those things are in competition with each other. So I wanted to look at this a little further. So, you know, that breaks down into basically about four different ideas. You know, the world's made of things. I am an individual, and my biology demonstrates this, and my thoughts are my own, and my actions are my own. And when I started looking at this from a subatomic point of view, and looking at smaller and smaller pieces of the universe, which is what scientists like to do, they like to take apart the universe like a great big radio and look for the smallest pieces, because they think then they can define the big pieces. And the more you look, the more you find more and more subatomic particles. And the reason they really can't be identified is because, as any quantum physicist will tell you, the smallest elements of the universe, subatomic particles, aren't things at all. They're not those little billiard balls as demonstrated in chemistry or physics classes. They are a vibrating packet of energy, trading energy with other vibrating packet of energies, almost like an endless game of tennis. And so the unit of the universe isn't a thing at all. It's a relationship. It's a relationship between subatomic particles, and it's a relationship between subatomic particles and this background energy field. So that we see mimicked in all of the universe. We now know that our biology, for instance, is hugely affected, and our DNA, which we think is the thing that creates us from inside out, is actually only like the keys of a piano. They sit there very statically, and they only get played by environmental influences, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the food we eat, the friends we have, you know, the sum total of how we live our lives. All of this determines whether a little quartet sitting above each gene turns on or off that gene. So what this really says is that, you know, we don't get developed from inside out. We get built and constructed and become who we are from outside in by our bond with our environment. And you see this
right,
even.
Right, and things are much more dynamic than we've been led to believe.
Absolutely. And we involve things even millions of miles away in our daily life. You know, the effect of everything is actually affects everything else. And the most dramatic example of that is the effect of the sun on us. You know, the sun is a big old ball of gases crossed with a lot of unstable magnetic fields. And that's a recipe for, you know, periodic explosions. And the sun hurls its gaseous stuff toward Earth. That hits a thing called the geomagnetic shield, which is a donut-shaped shield around the Earth. And scientists now know, and this isn't astrology, this is hard science, they know that this has a profound effect on living things, and particularly the electrical systems of living things, like the heart and the brain. So when this goes on, our heart attacks increase, our psychiatric visits increase, our epileptic fits increase, we get destabilized. But we now know that this also affects our behavior, because there have been some
right.
really interesting studies looking at solar cycles and the sun's, all this activity of the sun operates, waxes and wanes in a periodic cycle of about 11 years. And when they've looked at stock market activity, for instance, and terrorist activity, for instance, they found that that waxes and wanes also absolutely in time with the sun. So
right.
stock market activity, which is just human behavioral activity, you know, we're nervous, we sell, we're confident, we buy, all tracks this, you know, tracks that 11-year cycle perfectly. So it's quite interesting. What this all suggests is that instead of being an individual, self-contained individual, you know, if we can be affected by a star millions of miles away, that we are essentially an intergalactic superorganism. You know, we are
uh-huh.
part of this superorganism. And when we continue, you know, when we continue to think of ourselves as individuals, we inevitably, invariably steer wrong. When we think of ourselves as a holistic unit, an entity, then we move in the right direction, then we thrive.
Yeah, it's a reminder of that old quote, what we do to the other, we do to ourselves.
Absolutely. But, you know, that's not the way we live our lives right now. You know, we still
right.
are set in the old mindset. And so much of what I wanted to write about in the book, and I now teach a lot of how-to in my classes. I've got teleclasses, and I've got new programs. I'm teaching whole organizations how to create a coherence in the organization and then to become ambassadors of change, is all about wiping that old hard drive clean of the competitive mindset.
Well, let's talk about what you call the pull to wholeness, because one of the things you describe in the bond is the extent to which we really are fundamentally cooperative beings, and that's the basis of our success. That the human race really, we got to where we got by cooperating. And
yes.
and walk through some of the science. So maybe if we could go into that in just a little bit.
Sure. I mean, we've been told by a lot of the very reductive neo-Darwinists that we're actually born to be selfish, and that nature, as Nietzsche put it, has a, you know, is a will to power. And I found that that was completely untrue. All of the science, and I looked beyond physics this time. I looked at biology and psychology and anthropology and all of the economics and all theologies, and found that actually nature has a pull to wholeness. Nature has designed us to share, care, and be fair, not to compete. And you know, one of the most the greatest examples of that is our need to belong. You know, scientists have demonstrated that we have that not belonging is probably the worst thing that can happen to a human being. You know, suicides tend to kill themselves because of what psychologists call excessive individuation, and by that they mean they just feel left out. They haven't connected with the whole, and they have found that, I mean, a very interesting statistic, only half of heart attack victims have the usual risk factors like high cholesterol or, you know, clogged arteries. The rest are simply lonely. They literally die of a broken heart. And conversely,
right. One of my favorite lines from
found.
One of my favorite lines from Scripture is, guard your heart, for from it flows the wellspring of life. And your descriptions of the relationship between, you know, the health of your heart and the health of your community and connection is just astonishing.
Well, it astonished me, too, to realize that, you know, community is probably the best drug anybody can take. I mean, aside from protecting against heart attack, you know, having friends and having connection in a community has been demonstrated to be protective against depression, stroke, even the common cold. And, you know, they found just joining a couple of groups can have your risk of dying in the next year. So, I mean, this is, you know, hugely, hugely powerful and demonstrative of our need to belong. You know, even with the Japanese, I thought it was very interesting to see that they are, you know, when they move to the UK, the U.S., the Japanese have low heart disease, but when they move to the U.S., their heart disease oftentimes rises to that of ordinary Americans if they don't connect with their community. If they do, it doesn't matter what they eat, whether it's tofu and sushi or Big Macs and fries. What's really important, the only common denominator for success is community.
One of the stories you told, you, there are many wonderful stories in the Bond, but one is about the town in Pennsylvania.
Yes,
I don't remember their name. Where they had remarkably superior health statistics because of the bonding of the community. Did I remember
that
correctly?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a really interesting community, which has been written about. But what I found so interesting about it was that rich lived side by side with poor, but didn't flaunt it. And they all worked together. They had been a beleaguered group of Italians who were kind of discriminated against by the Protestants who lived there before them. But they were mainly transplants from the old country. And they all worked together, putting flowers around the town. They created their own little band. They had their own little groups, their Knights of Columbus. And they became a really coherent community flushed with common pride. And also, as I say, the rich decided not to flaunt it. And so there was this real, real connection. And consequently, they were a little bubble that had a very low heart attack risk compared to neighboring communities. But then as soon as the next generation or so began to live like ordinary Americans and move outside of this little bubble of connection, then their heart attack rate began to mimic that of the rest of the country. So I think they're a wonderful example of what to do to, you know, maintain this kind of community coherence. And as I say, a real important thing is eliminating the whole thing of, you know, flaunting and or keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah, that really was underscored. Envy is bad for your health and bad for community.
Definitely, definitely. Both you, the person doing it, and the other person witnessing it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about actions, because I think, you know, as I was going through the Bond, I kept thinking, what are the actions I need to take as a result of this? So let's just start with you. How has writing the Bond changed your life, your behavior? What actions have you taken?
Well, I have put together a whole big program for changing four things. And this is the four things that I felt were really important. And one of them has been really impacted on me. The four things are, in terms of wiping our hard drive clean, the last third of the book, which is, how do we see much more holistically? How do we relate much more holistically? So it's not just about what's in it for me, but how do I serve? How do we connect across what we consider deeper and deeper divides? And how do we take personal responsibility for being the change? I think those were the real important aspects that I found. And I think what's impacted me most has been, I mean, I've been practicing various techniques for a long time that helped me see more holistically. But I think changing the way I relate to people was really important, because I found that, you know, unconsciously, and all of us have this, even the most spiritual, so-called spiritual among us, are all imbued with this mindset that of I win, you lose. And so it really requires a big paradigm shift of looking and recognizing you know, catching yourself when you start labeling people as the other, and you start labeling them according to essentially clichés. You know, because, you know, Republicans and Democrats all want mostly
right.
the same things. You know, we all want
right.
to take care of our children. You know, we all want to not pay too many taxes. We all want the roads to be half decent. We all want good schools. You know, we all want the same stuff. But we've ended up demonizing each other for stupid and trivial reasons oftentimes, and when there's so many ways we can make connections. And I felt that what was really important were techniques that I teach now that I've put together a program of how to connect even when you don't agree, and how not
right.
to consider that as a real problem. Consider that as a creative solution, or the means.
Right.
To,
I love the description
in
the bond of the group that got together to talk about abortion. So you had people on completely opposite sides of the spectrum ideologically, but when they started to get to know each other and communicate, something very powerful and different happened. And, you know,
absolutely. I mean, it was so interesting
yeah.
with that situation, because they learned to share deeply and from the heart, and to stop demonizing the other, but just to share deeply and listen deeply, and not to be afraid of difference. And once they did that, connections started being created. It wasn't just common ground. It was kind of a, you know, superior ground. They, you know,
right.
when there were some threats on the Planned Parenthoods, it was the pro-life people who tipped off their pro-choice friends. And ultimately, even though they decided and realized that they didn't agree, and they felt very deeply about what they believed in, and maybe it was different, they, you know, they partied together. They watched each other's children. They began to, you know, love each other. And that's the point, is not being really afraid of difference. You know, we don't have to have the same to be friends.
Right. One of the things I see a lot in my work is currently we have a debt-based currency and debt-based economy, which tends to promote this win-lose kind of incentive. If we're going
mm-hmm.
to build an equity-based economy, equity is all about aligning, you know, and finding
mm-hmm.
accord. And one
yeah.
of the reasons I so enjoy both the field and the bond is, you know, the question for most of us is, okay, well, we're in this debt-based trap. How do we get, you know, to something that can build alignment? And just having the scientific foundation, you know, gives you the confidence to go out and do that.
Yes.
You know, because the
yes.
practical struggle we deal with this win-lose, you know, stuff that's gotten engineered into so many incentive systems is very, very real. Well, I interrupted you, so go through the four. Finish going through the four.
No, so, okay, well, and then as I say, but I thank you for that, and I think that is the real purpose of the bond, which is to rewrite our story. I mean, I felt that was really my first function, because I think we have to first rewrite the story of who we are before we can figure out how to live in a new way.
Right.
So that was
right.
the first purpose of it. Now, this third idea about connecting across deep divides, I was fascinated by one of the most beloved psychological studies of all time that really gave me the idea. It was 1950s, it concerned 22 12-year-old boys who were sent to summer camp in two separate buses, and they were encouraged to have
yeah.
separate identities. Sorry?
Yeah, this is fascinating.
Sorry,
go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And they were encouraged to have separate identities, separate names, so one chose Rattlers, the other chose Eagles, and they were put in separate houses. And watching all of this were a group of camp counselors who were actually psychologists in disguise. And, you know, they got them involved in neck-and-neck competition and engineered the results so that they would always be very close, one and the other, and they were fighting over much-coveted prizes. Now, after a while, the scientists didn't have to engineer anything because the kids were killing each other. They were, under these highly competitive circumstances, they were ripping up each other's flags and invading each other's houses and stealing each other's presents and prizes, and they just hated each other. and nothing could stop them from hating each other. So the psychologist then engineered a series of crises in the camp that could only be sorted out by the collective efforts of all the boys involved. So the boys had to work together, for instance, to remove an impediment that had been put in the water supply, and they had to work together to pull a truck out that had fallen into a ditch, or that had been placed essentially into a ditch. And magic then began to happen. The boys began to eat together, they began to talk to each other, and started to become friends with each other, and ultimately unanimously voted to ride home together. And one of the heads of one of the groups, the Rattlers or Eagles, spent all of his prize money on ice creams for the whole group. So what they engaged in is called a superordinate goal. And scientists have seen that whenever this is used, it's the most brilliant thing. And by that I mean, you know, engaging everyone in a bigger goal that can only be sorted and achieved by the collective efforts of everyone involved. Doing that seems to reach across divides and unite people. And you see it in so many different examples. But when I looked into the science of it, it was very obvious why it works. The science shows that when we work for a collective purpose, our brainwaves start operating in synchrony. And there's another bit of evidence, too, looking at studies of Oxford rowers. They show that when they row as a group, they have a much higher pain threshold individually than they do when they're rowing on their own. So you know, working together for a common goal also raises everybody's game. So that seemed to me to be one of the real key elements for reaching across big divides.
And number four?
Number four is taking responsibility to become one of the changes, be the change that you want to see. And I can best illustrate that by the work of Nipun Mehta. Mehta was the prototypical Silicon Valley Turk who was on six figures right after he got out of university. And, you know, after a while, he got sickened by, you know, the conversations of all of his colleagues. It seemed that all he was hearing about was who was getting the next Mercedes or who had the biggest new stock option. So he decided to do something radical. He felt he was living in the greediest area of America with the highest per capita income and the lowest level of charitable donation. So he wondered whether or not he could change this culture by creating little acts of generosity and creating a little microcosm of generosity. So he wanted to see if he could do that. So the first thing he did was convince his mom to open up her door to 50 strangers every week. This amazing mom. And so he would invite 50 people in, anyone, rich, poor, anyone, people he didn't know, and have them come in and meditate together. And then they'd share a conversation, all discuss any old thing, and they'd all get a shot at the mic. And then mom would feed all 50. And this would happen every Wednesday. So he did this, and a new batch of 50 would come every single week. And it's gone on for 15, 16 years now, and no one has stolen so much as a teaspoon. Nothing. No incidents whatsoever. And the only fights that ever break out is who's going to do the dishes. Because when generosity is the currency, the game starts changing.
Right.
So, I mean, Mehta does all kinds of refinements. He's put bookshelves up and just filled them with inspirational books. And he just has a sign saying, take whatever you want. And now he has more books than he started with. Because more people are giving books than taking books. When generosity is the currency, the game starts changing. So Mehta's is very interesting to me when I looked at it scientifically, what happens and why this happens. And they've shown two things. One is we're hugely affected. One of the areas I talk about in the bond is how emotionally contagious we are and behaviorally contagious. But they also find that when we do good deeds, they are also contagious. So for every act of generosity, it actually ripples down social networks. So if you're nice to Jane, she's more likely to be nice to Tom. He's more likely to be nice to Pete. Pete's more likely to be nice to Sam, and so forth. And so you can create this contagion of generosity that can change a culture. And they've also found with scientific studies that all it requires in a culture of greed are one or two people wedded to fairness and wedded to reciprocity to change the whole game and turn it around. So a perfect example of this is a girl called Marie, a woman called Marie. She was in the typical company, you know, a typical dog-eat-dog company. And this got tiring to her, so she wanted to see if she could do anything about it. So she decided to leave change in her Coke, in the company's Coke machine every day with a little sign saying, "Your Coke has been paid for. Keep the spirit alive and pay it forward." This completely freaks out her coworkers. They start creating a kind of a spy network to find out who the secret Santa is. So Marie moves floors at this point, and she starts leaving donuts every day with the same sign. It becomes a dinner table conversation for weeks, and before long, it becomes the little impetus that completely changes the culture of that company. And it's that simple. You know, we're all so connected and interconnected. We're all so desirous of connecting with each other, that all it takes is one or two people to remind us of who we really are to change the game completely.
Well, Lynn, this has been very inspiring. Now, before we end, I would love it if you could. We all know how to buy your books, and I want to remind the subscribers, these are books you absolutely want to get, you absolutely want to read, you want to have them in your library, you want to share them with your friends. But tell us about how we can access the magazine and the teleseminars and keep up with your work on an ongoing basis.
Thank you. If you want to find out more about The Bond and our upcoming teleseminars, please visit thebond.net or my major site, lynnmctaggart.com. For information about What Doctors Don't Tell You, the newsletter, and soon to be the magazine, please come to www.wddty.com. That's for What Doctors Don't Tell You, wddty.com. And finally, if you'd like to be part of our intention experiments, come to theintentionexperiment.com.
Now, what's the next teleseminar?
My next teleseminar is Surviving and Thriving in the Post-Recession Economy. And it's going to be all about how do we live, how do we start thriving and prospering in this current situation? What do we have to do that's different? And what do we have to learn about that's different? And it involves completely changing the way you live and work in the sense of altering what your expectations are and altering the way that you relate to other people. And I've been working with a couple of groups, as I say, and we're finding remarkable things, just putting some of these bond practices to work.
Okay, well, that sounds fascinating. Okay, well, books, magazines, teleseminars, there's a lot of ways to plug in. Lynn McTaggart, thank you so much for everything you're doing. This is all wonderful material and wonderful support for each one of us as we grapple with how to reinvent our lives and reinvent everything. And I can't tell you what a difference you've made to my life, and I'm sure you're going to make a big difference to my subscribers. So again, thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report, and have just a wonderful day.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. Take care.
Okay, that was Lynn McTaggart. I wanted to tell a story because I want to emphasize why I think the material in Lynn's books and that you've heard tonight is so important. It was 2005, and I was over in Helena in Montana with a very successful and brilliant entrepreneur, and we were at a conference, we bumped into a whole group of energetic healers, and so I tried to explain to him what energetic healing was, and then I tried to get the energetic healers to explain to him the notion of a non-local field and the extent to which all knowledge can be accessed through time and space, and how intention can change things, and how everyone, you know, we may not have political power, but we have power through the field. So he listened and digested, and we were driving back at high speed that night through the snow and the forest in Montana, and suddenly he screeched the car to the halt, and he turned to me and he said, "If what you're saying is true, then we can win." And what he meant was the power of billions of people thinking in a win-win way and using their attention in a focused way was more powerful than all the weapons and all the tricks of the centralizers in the world, and that's absolutely true. And it's one of the reasons I continue to be an optimist. So I think at the end of the day, what this informs us is where real power comes from. And so I encourage you to pick up on Lynn's work. And I think the field and the bond really bring a whole lot of science and what's exploding in the world of silence down to something that's easy reading for us. In closing, coming up, let me just mention, let's go to the movies. Our movie this week is I Am, which is a 2011 documentary film which was both written, narrated, and directed by Tom Shadyac, a very talented filmmaker known for his comedies like Ace Ventura, Detective. He had a bicycle accident several years ago and as a result started to contemplate the fundamental nature of reality and decided he would make a documentary asking the question, what's wrong with the world and what can we do about it? And it's a lovely movie. It's a very feel-good movie. He completely avoids taking a look at the tapeworm. So instead, he's kind of looking at many of the issues, sort of the fundamental nature of human relationships and behavior. And he interviews Lynn McTaggart. There's some great interviews with Lynn there. Some great interviews with another hero of mine, Elizabeth Sestouris. Another one, David Suzuki. So it's a pleasant movie to watch. It's, again, a very talented filmmaker. And, of course, it skates it skates a lot of the negative issues, but it's very interesting for some of the things that Lynn and Elizabeth and folks like them talk about. So I encourage you to get it and watch it. I Am. The trailer's up on the blog. Next week I'll be in Rogue Valley. For any of you in Oregon, I would encourage you to come out to those events. You'll see them described up on the events section of the blog. Then the first week in February, I'll be out in California for the month. We have John Rapoport, one of my favorite writers and thinkers in the whole world. We'll be talking about the nuts and bolts of the Matrix. And then the following week, Precious Metals with Franklin. Precious Metals continues to move up. We have a lot to talk about. So until whether I see you in the Flathead Valley for lunch on Saturday or in Rogue Valley, or we talk next with John Rapoport, until then, please don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. And if you listen to Lynn McTaggart, it'll be good for your heart. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.